This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Wells Fargo CEO John Stumpf suddenly retires. North Carolina continues to be the center of attention for presidential campaigns. Mike Pence spends time in Charlotte this week. Tim Kaine comes to Davidson. Donald Trump is here tonight. Pat McCrory and Roy Cooper face off in their first televised debate. Keith Scott's widow appears with Gayle King on CBS This Morning to tell her side of the story in CMPD's shooting of her husband. And CMS not only begins working on their magnet plan, they've decided to invite a student advisor to join them, something County Commissioner Bill James has said he wants no part of. Our roundtable of reporters is set to talk about these stories and more. We're joined by WFAE Sarah D'Elia, Sean Flynn, managing editor of Time Warner Cable News, Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer at the Charlotte Business Journal, and Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer. You can reach us through email at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks and use the hashtag WFAE Roundup. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you. Months after revelations of bogus accounts being created for unknowing customers at Wells Fargo in their retail operation, a week after some clients complained of similar activity in their wealth management accounts, and after enduring withering cross-examination in front of the Senate and House banking committees, John Stumpf, the longtime president and CEO, suddenly resigned or retired effective immediately this week. Why the timing? Anybody know?
Well, I just don't think that they could put up with any more of the bleeding, so to speak. His performance on Capitol Hill or performances were widely panned. The bank has come under withering criticism for the way it's handled these revelations. And I think it was just time to, you know, try and end some of the barrage of horrible public relations. Mm.
And the bank has paid $185 million in fines to the government, which sounds small to me. They have clawed back compensation from the woman, whose name escapes me at the moment, who was in charge of the retail division that had these cross-selling practices in place. Stumpf had been one of the highest paid bank executives in the industry, but the
Harry Tolstad, I believe, is the
Harry Tolstad, and he made $19.3 million in salary, bonus, and stock last year, and the board already reduced that income in light of the scandal, announcing he would forfeit all of his outstanding unvested equity awards, which are worth $41 million. Did he get a golden parachute to leave?
Well, there's still question or uncertainty about whether the board will take further action in terms of what he walks away with. So we don't know yet. But, you know, those steps that you just mentioned are clearly in response to the negative reaction from Congress, from the public, from shareholders. So, and the other thing I should mention, Mike, is that this is nowhere near over. There are so many investigations going on from Justice Department, State Department, State Attorneys General, on and on, so we're nowhere near the end of this road.
That, of course, is Eric Spanberg, who's the senior staff writer from the Charlotte Business Journal, and he covers this all the time. Were any of the customers affected by the retail banking bogus accounts, were they made whole? Were they permanently damaged in any way?
They are being made whole, the bank says, and there is discussion of, ta-da, class action lawsuits. We don't know what's going to happen there just yet, but the bank says it has begun repairing whatever damage was done.
Anybody at the bank likely to face criminal charges?
Well, that's what we'll see with some of these various government investigations.
The board has now separated the chairman and the CEO positions and named current president and chief operating officer Tim Sloan as the new CEO. He's based out of Los Angeles, I believe.
Correct.
Well, Wells Fargo is Charlotte's largest employer. So what is this shakeup likely to mean for people who work at the bank here?
Well, I don't know that it's going to be. Go ahead, Sean.
I was just going to say we actually looked into that yesterday, and a lot of the economic professors and the people in the industry that we spoke to said that they don't see an immediate impact. They actually see that it could potentially lead to more jobs here. Mr. Sloan actually has family who lives in Mooresville, so he does have some sort of connection to the area and the region. But I think even since 2008, when we went through the crisis and all the Wachovia people were going, you know, the whole city was fearful of what was going to happen. Then, you know, John Stumpf came in and said, hey, we like Charlotte. We're going to continue to bring jobs. They've added jobs since then. So I think at this point, they just got to get through this controversy and then move forward from there.
I was going to mention one thing real quick, though, Mike, and this was in the Wall Street Journal today, and they were referencing John Stumpf. Elizabeth Warren, who, of course, has been very critical, asked him about Carrie Tolstead at one point, and his answer was, well, at the time she was reporting to our president chief operating officer, who, of course, is now the CEO.
So this is far from over.
Right.
Okay, we have a short show today, so let's move on to the vice presidential candidates being in Charlotte recently. We're a key battleground state. The New York Times is predicting, based on the compilation of a number of polls, that Hillary Clinton has a 65% chance to take the state's 15 electoral votes. The latest polls have her up by 1, maybe 2 points, which is, I guess, within the margin of error. They also say that Hillary's increasing success is not rubbing off on the Senate race, where Senator Richard Burr still has a 71% chance of retaining his seat, leading Deborah Ross by 2 to 5 points. Any surprise there at all?
Not really. I think, she did not have huge name recognition before this race, and I think she has a pretty steep hill to climb in terms of, getting to the point where people, know her well enough and see her as a viable alternative to Richard Burr, who's been around, who's been in Congress more than 20 years, mm-hmm. A fixture.
And we'll talk – they had a debate last night with Jonathan Carl from ABC News moderating. All these big heavy hitters coming in to moderate these debates. And we'll talk about that later. But she seemed, at least initially, very nervous.
Yeah, you did get the sense of, kind of the AAA player getting called up to the major leagues and, kind of staring at the lights like, wow, I'm finally here. But I think she did kind of settle down towards the latter part of it. And she did seem, kind of tentative, especially on the questions about, foreign affairs, Aleppo, Syria, that kind of stuff. But she seemed on firmer ground when they got to more domestic stuff.
We'll talk about that a little bit later in the program. Both vice presidential candidates were here following the last town hall debate. Mike Pence came to Charlotte, I believe, on Monday. Yeah. Tim Kaine was in Davidson. What did they say? Anything substantive that's news?
It seemed to be basically what we're hearing from both sides, that it's the same pitch. I didn't hear a whole lot new. Did anyone else?
Well, the only thing I heard new was when Pence came on Monday, it was the first time he had been at a rally since the tapes came out over the weekend and he canceled some events. So it was his first time. Everyone was waiting to hear what is he going to say about his running mate. And, of course, he's came out and supported his running mate and continued on the same message that they were on.
And that came on the heels of Donald Trump making a statement during that debate on Sunday night where he disagreed. He made it clear that they hadn't spoken and that he disagreed. And it looked like he was really angry.
In a very clipped tone, yes. Mm-hmm.
So Mike Pence seemed to be back on the train in Charlotte the very next day. Do you think they had conversations before he
I don't know, but I just find Mike Pence endlessly fascinating right now. I mean, a Christian conservative who had all these, sort of bona fides for being, sort of a man of, faith and integrity. And now he's,
out talking about excess Hollywood tapes.
Yeah.
Surreal to watch this.
Joined at the hip with, his polar opposite and having to defend the indefensible.
Yeah. Go ahead. And it was within the first couple of minutes that he immediately kind of nipped that and said, he kind of went on this stump speech about his religion and Christianity. And that really resonated with people in that crowd that were there on Monday. Mike Pence kind of stuck to his talking points. What was more interesting to me about attending that rally was the people that I talked to before and after, because the questions were, did you see the debate? What did you think, how do you think Mr. Trump did? And have those tapes changed your mind, or have they made you think about your vote in a different way? And overwhelmingly, the answers that I got were Mr. Trump did a great job in the debate, and of course, preaching to the choir at that rally, but also, no, these tapes and this audio isn't going to sway us in any way. It's unfortunate. No one really wants to hear their party's presidential candidate making those comments, but overwhelmingly, I thought that was really interesting to hear.
Pence told the crowd there that Donald Trump literally, these are his words, literally embodies the spirit of America. He is willing to fight every day for what he believes in and what makes this nation great. And about the video, he added, it takes a big man to know when he's wrong and to admit it. Donald Trump showed last night that he is a big man.
Yeah. As I said, Mike Pence is extremely fascinating right now. It's just, okay. What can you say?
If you look at that comment, I mean, regardless of what you think of Donald Trump, he is a fighter, and that is the American spirit. Yeah. So there you go.
Yeah, and so is Hillary Clinton, according
Excellent.
To Donald Trump.
Yeah, according to Donald Trump, exactly.
Okay,
everyone agrees.
We have to take a break. Donald Trump is coming here today. We'll talk a little bit about that. We'll also go into the McCrory-Cooper debate and the Richard Byrd-Deborah Ross debate, which was last night on statewide television. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. We have our roundtable of reporters here, Sarah D'Elia from our WFAE newsroom, Sean Flynn, managing editor of Time Warner Cable News, Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal, and Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer. We've been talking about the vice presidential candidates coming to town to speak here in the last week. Tonight, Donald Trump is here again. I don't know how many times he's been here, but he's been here a lot. And they moved the venue from PNC Arena, the amphitheater, I think, to the convention center, which has the larger capacity. Does anybody know?
Sure.
I think the amphitheater would definitely have to have the larger. I mean, you can get 18,000 people.
So what is this saying? If they move it to the convention center, does that mean that he's diminished interest in him because of what's
going on? I'm
pretty
sure that didn't the campaign say this was a logistical issue because they'd added a Greensboro at 2:00, and I didn't know if that was trying to move him from one to the other. I have no idea.
Here's my conspiracy theory. We all know that Donald Trump does not like the media, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So the convention center is extremely hard for TV news stations to get out of. So he's just trying to make it hard on us.
Okay, Sean.
Get to the press.
Just sticking it to us.
When these candidates come to town, whether the presidential candidates or the vice presidential candidates, they're talking primarily to supporters, right?
Right.
So what's the point? Aside from TV coverage, what's the point?
Well, but I think that's a big point, is that you keep your base motivated. You keep them enthusiastic. You hope that they go out and encourage other people to go out and vote. And then you need the attention. I mean, look, as has been said 80 gazillion times, he's absolutely got to have North Carolina. Virginia is long gone. Georgia is precarious.
In fact, the National Party, has pulled – they've told the Donald Trump campaign, you can campaign in Virginia, but it's going to be on your dime. We're not spending any more money in Virginia for you. They're continuing in North Carolina and Ohio and Florida. So I'm not sure why they – maybe Virginia's a lost cause in there.
At this point.
Yeah, yeah it is. Yeah, it is. And that's why, I mean, Mike, look, you not only had, you mentioned Pence, Donald Trump Jr. was here in the Charlotte area yesterday, and he's been in other parts of North Carolina. So if anyone is sick of presidential candidates coming to the area, you better go away for 3 weeks.
We talked a little bit about what Mike Pence said when he was here on Monday. Tim Kaine was also in town or near town. He was in Davidson. And aside from faulting Donald Trump's apology for the comments he made about women aboard that Access Hollywood bus in 2005, Kaine went on to condemn this state's voter ID law and HB2. He criticized HB2 for being discriminatory and as an example of a heavy-handed attempt by the legislature to thwart the will of local voters. How does that help the Clinton campaign?
Well, I think that resonates with Democrats. Democrats, I think, largely feel that way. And when you look at, for example, Jennifer Roberts and the Democratic majority on city council, they've all said very similar things. And so I think as you go across the state, if you're talking to Democrats, that's the kind of message you want to send to them. And, you know, conversely, that's the kind of thing that drives Republicans crazy and probably out to the polls. Mm-hmm.
It's also probably a way to try and galvanize the Democratic Party, who may not be entirely behind Hillary Clinton. You know, let's just face it. She's not getting the crowds that Bernie Sanders was. And so they're trying to get people who are really embroiled in an issue. Obviously, HB2, that fires people up.
He also told the crowd that if we win North Carolina, we will be victorious on November the 8th. Is that
accurate? That's conventional wisdom, yeah.
So this is – we're the linchpin. We're the one.
Yeah.
This
Trump can't win without North Carolina.
Hillary, but Clinton can win without North Carolina, but Trump cannot.
Right. And that's why he's here over and over, and Mike Pence and any other surrogate who's available.
So the big news all of this week began last Friday afternoon late when they released that Access Hollywood tape. And since then, women have come out or are beginning to come out to say that they were manhandled or attacked or molested by Donald Trump. The other controversy of the week has been the WikiLeaks ongoing stream of emails from the Clinton campaign and from mostly from Clinton campaign staffers. I have not seen – there have been lots of leaks, and I haven't seen any of them, but the reporting that I have seen on all of this focuses on staff members, not on emails sent by Hillary Clinton. What have we learned about the Clinton campaign? What is damning about these WikiLeaks emails that might hurt the Clinton campaign?
Well, it basically reinforces the conventional wisdom that you already had about Hillary Clinton and her campaign, which is just that it's very tightly controlled, very tightly scripted,
Except for the Trump campaign.
Well, yeah.
Aren't all of them
Trump.
That way?
Yeah, except hers.
She's
maybe,
especially so.
Yeah, especially
right.
so. I mean, there was one email or a series of emails, I can't remember, that talked about how I think four different staff members were debating on and on and on about one tweet.
Right.
That she was supposed to, go out.
But what's wrong with that?
Well, actually, that's a good point.
That would have happened in a conference room in 1950. It would have happened on the phone in 1960. Now it's happening on Twitter.
Here's what's going on, though, Mike. You never heard, or we never heard, those conference room conversations where the language is a lot blunter and where people
locker roomish.
Well, I was dancing around that horrible phrase, but where people are saying things about who they like and who they don't like and voting blocks. There were the comments about Bill Richardson, the former New Mexico governor, and others. And so no campaign wants that getting out in the public.
Yeah. I think the Clinton campaign is trying to get her away from that elitist image, and a lot of these emails are exactly that. They're talking about targeting needy Hispanics. They went after Catholics and different groups that weren't too happy to hear and read some of those images.
If you communicate on Twitter, you only have 140 characters. You're going to shorten the conversation. So saying needy, I'm not trying to be
No, but these are emails. These aren't emails.
But even so,
right.
We all know how we speak differently than what we send in emails. And sometimes the way we send emails is, gets us into trouble because you cannot – You don't hear inflection, et cetera, and you're trying to be short. So saying needy Hispanics might be said in a conversation as being said, if we pay more attention, they need somebody to pay attention to that. It sounds different. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
That's true, but I think there are also elements of sort of casual snarkiness that, that go on. Again, I'm not saying that this is shocking. I'm saying that these are the kinds of things that a campaign, especially one that's this tightly controlled, does not want out in public.
Yeah.
And look, Republicans, Democrats, whenever you get a hold of anything that you can maneuver into something that's unflattering, that's what you're going to do. That's politics.
For me, the whole thing makes me more comfortable in a way with Hillary Clinton and her campaign because, it's like you always had this question about what exactly does she stand for? What does she really believe in? Is it just me that I'm not really feeling that coming? What Bernie's about. You know what Trump's about. But what exactly is she, at her core, who is she? And in these emails that come out, you see that they are struggling with that same question. So you kind of get a sense of, okay, so it's not just me. I can see, and there's no real boogeyman in these emails,
right.
Even though Trump and his guys are trying hard to spin it that way. She's just a conventional politician,
But there is
for best, there is for very good much, and ill.
There's very much the sense that trying to get to the core of who she is and how they're going to present her is an eternally vexing question for them.
Yeah.
All this news about the presidential campaign, we have a gubernatorial race going on that everybody's forgotten about, I think. Well, maybe not everybody, but there was a debate this week between Governor Pat McCrory. He met for an hour on a stage with Attorney General Roy Cooper in the first of two televised debates, this one moderated by NBC's Chuck Todd. Any surprises that came out of that debate?
No, not really. Yeah. It seemed to be about what you'd expect.
Who won?
Although McCrory was the aggressor, it seemed like.
I think McCrory,
which he kind of has to be, I guess.
If anything, I feel like McCrory wins for having the most fire in their belly. Like, he definitely had this look of really wanting to keep his job during the whole debate. And Roy Cooper, while articulate and, you know, debated well, I did get that sense of urgency more from Governor McCrory.
I was going to ask who made the most effective impression for themselves and what they stand for. And Roy Cooper, to my knowledge, has never lost a race that he competed in. And yet, at least at the initial outset of this debate, he looked like he'd never run for office before. The energy level between the two of them was shocking.
Yeah. The other thing I took away from Cooper the other night was there was a little bit of a sing-songy, Al Gore-ish kind of lockbox, as he was trying to break down issues at times. On other issues he was stronger, but there was kind of a this is all purely just intuitive, but there was a little bit of that. I agree overwhelmingly with the sentiment that McCrory had to be aggressive. He was aggressive, and he took the fight to him. Of course, the other thing is anybody really still trying to make up their minds? I mean, these candidates are pretty different.
Yeah. Right. And I also think with Roy Cooper, he sees the polls. He's just like, I just cannot say anything stupid. Yeah.
Correct. Right.
Don't trip over my own tongue.
And I got to tell you, to old timers like me who watched that debate, it was so refreshing. I mean, it was so reminiscent of earlier presidential debates, as was the senatorial debate last night.
Yeah. They actually talked about issues.
Yeah, they talked about issues. They were professional. They were polite.
They were adults.
They were adults in the room. Do you think that we can get back to that at the presidential level in 4 years, or will this, what we're witnessing at the presidential level, filter down into the gubernatorial and Senate races in 4 to 6 years?
No, I think this is, at the presidential level, this is just the Trump anomaly. I mean, if Donald Trump's in the room or on the stage, it's not going to be a typical presidential debate.
Yeah, I do have to say that the gubernatorial debate, while it may not have been as flashy as some of the presidential debates, it was the most watchable because you could actually hear the people saying their points and debating with one another. And that was kind of refreshing.
I was going to say real quick, Mike, you know, the other thing that strikes me, it's obvious, but Governor McCrory has not gone through this campaign saying that if he loses that the whole thing is rigged, for example. You know, there's sort of an adult level of discourse here in the governor's race that is much different than what we're seeing at the presidential level.
And they weren't doing battle with the moderator either.
Right.
And accusing the moderator of being unfair. And I thought that Chuck Todd, who is a consummate professional, did a great job, as did Jonathan Carl, who was obviously battling a cold or something last night from ABC.
Interject there, though. Yes. I said this 4 years ago. I do have an issue with somebody from the national level coming in and doing North Carolina debates. I don't,
because they don't know the,
because they're not here.
That's right.
I really think a journalist from North Carolina, I'm not saying from my organization or whatever, but I really would rather see somebody from North Carolina who works with all these people all the time be the moderator.
But don't you think they were prepped?
Oh, absolutely.
And why do they do this? This is obviously they had to pay these guys a lot of money to come down here and do this. So why did they do that?
I think one of the reasons
to
is
be
that
fair,
I was going to say it removes any sort of, well, your paper or your organization did this or that. I mean, it's just he's Chuck Todd from NBC coming in or Jonathan Carl from ABC. He really has no
horse
dog in the fight. Right.
Yeah.
That being said, I thought they both did a great job.
All right. last night was the senatorial debate between Republican Senator Richard Burr and Democratic challenger Deborah Ross last night. How would you characterize what went on there?
It was a little sleepy, but, let's not be hypocritical about this. They did talk about issues. It was civil, and it's probably the way debates need to go.
And it started with conversation about, guess what, Donald Trump. and Deborah Ross said that she was disturbed by Trump's comments about women and hit Burr for not rescinding his endorsement of the GOP's presidential nominee.
Senator Burr has stuck by Donald Trump during all of this, and I think that that shows a lack of judgment. Senator Burr has towed the party line even when Donald Trump has crossed the line.
That sounds like a nicely practiced line. Burr turned Ross's lack of judgment criticism around on Hillary Clinton and reiterated his support for Trump.
I think bad judgment is when one chooses to lie about emails and to lie about things like Benghazi, where four Americans lost their life. I'm not going to defend Donald Trump, what he said or his actions. I've spoken out quickly and loudly when I disagreed with something. But when I look at our choice, it's not close for me.
Any minds changed by any of that, do you think?
No, I don't think so. I mean, maybe some independents out there that were on the fence, maybe. But I just – when we get to this point and I look at these candidates in these races, I'm baffled as to how you wouldn't have selected one or the other because they're – very dissimilar people.
Yeah. We'll talk a little bit more about that debate last night in a moment when we come back. Deborah Ross evidently has some tax credit problems that she's now facing. And Rakia Scott, Keith Scott's widow, was on CBS This Morning this week alleging that CMPD has lied about the investigation. We'll come back and talk about those things and more in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup with Eric Frazier, editorial writer from the Charlotte Observer, Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer from the Charlotte Business Journal, Sean Flynn, managing editor of Time Warner Cable News, and Sarah D'Elia from WFAE News. We were talking before the break about the debate between Richard Burr and Deborah Ross last night. They touched on a number of different topics. Among them, Senator Burr was asked by Jonathan Carl, do you think there is a systemic problem with racist bias in law enforcement? Senator Burr did not answer, but he did suggest that we need to give people good jobs. So Jonathan Carl came back, pressed him, and said that he would probably be the last one to answer that because it depends on each individual department. Yeah. Would that not be true?
Yeah, but in a sense, yeah, that would be true.
Mm-hmm.
But I think when I heard how he answered that, I just saw, from my perspective, he just seemed to be a guy at a very distant remove from that whole issue.
Well,
he just looked like, boy, I hadn't really thought about this. Let me think about
that. And he said in Charlotte's case, it was African-American officers who probably wouldn't show racial bias because he said African-American officers. There's only one African-American.
There was only, and I think Eric or anyone here, correct me, I feel pretty certain that I've seen studies that show that bias against minorities is even occurring with minority officers.
Right. It's the race of the subject, not the race of the officer.
And Ross said that we've seen this all over the country, and she advocates cooperation between cops and community and touted her record of working on these issues and accused him of voting down additional funding for community policing. And he accused her of always defending criminals. Truth on both sides or are both of those exaggerations?
I'm going to go with B.
Yeah.
Truth is always fuzzy in politics.
So Deborah Ross has suddenly had troubles not unlike those experienced by other politicians. She's been talking about her promotion of generous tax incentives for renovations to preserve the historic character of some of North Carolina's neighborhoods. But now it has been discovered that she and her husband benefited from those credits, qualifying for more than $267,000 in credits, direct deductions from their taxes for renovation and preserving the original features of a house that they own in Raleigh's historic Boylan Heights neighborhood. She broke no laws, but does this smell enough to cause her any damage?
It's one of those deals where it's like the thing they like to say in politics, an optics problem. You know, it's more of an optics problem than anything else. That there's no evidence that she did anything wrong or unethical or, it's just that she happened to,
Yeah, I think
be a beneficiary of these policies.
I think the thing that resonates much more is what you've seen the outside groups and Senator Burr himself go after, which is the ACLU link. That's yeah, really the big yeah. thing, this argument about what she favored with this sex criminal registry. Those are the issues, I think, that are going to continue to resonate most with Burr's voters.
Mm. Yeah, it's been kind of interesting to watch that whole sort of tug of war go back and forth,
yeah.
especially in the advertising where she's fought back really hard with Fountain Odom, who was the creator of that law, sort of going to bat for her and saying that she was helping him with the sex offender registry, not fighting it, although there were points at which she expressed some concerns, and those are the parts that Senator Burr is sort of zeroing in on. It's kind of hard to tell which side is breaking through to the yeah. average everyday voter. But we'll see.
Keith Lamont Scott's widow, Rakia Scott, went on CBS this morning. This week, told Gayle King that she doesn't believe a black police officer killed her husband. And that contradicts the scenario that CMPD laid out, but it also goes along with at least one of the many conspiracy theories that are cropping up around this incident. But she was there. Do we know what the videos show?
Well, we know what the videos don't show, and the videos don't show a clear image of a gun in Keith Scott's hand. And she still is saying, and she said on CBS that he did not have a gun, and she also said that Officer Brantley Vinson did not shoot him. So those are the two things.
He's the black officer.
The
and
black
I watched
officer.
The video
yeah.
again yesterday, and I can't figure out where he is in the video. Was he behind him? Was
I
he?
I think he's behind him.
So there were three officers, two that are near the car that Mr. Scott got out of, and mm-hmm. then he's the black officer is off camera from the dash cam video until later in the video after the shooting has already occurred, correct?
Correct.
So she says that he didn't shoot her, but according to the second autopsy, they say that the first shot was likely the one that hit Mr. Scott in the back. So that would be coming from the black police officer who was behind him. That shot punctured his lung and his aorta, and the second severed his spine, leaving him paralyzed. Also from watching the video, I can't tell where the shots are coming from.
Yeah,
are they all coming from the back?
Can't tell.
Well, and that's the thing, one of the many things that is distressing or frustrating about this is even with the video, I think most people, it's murky.
Yeah,
nobody can really tell much from it.
The New York Times had a really interesting thing that they did the other day where they sort of put together this composite from all the videos and did this graphic sort of showing here's where all the officers are. And it wasn't really that clear to me from all these disparate pieces of video, but when you look at the overall graphic, he's surrounded by, they're surrounding him on pretty much every side. And you do kind of come away from looking at that graphic of this guy, in a ring of police officers, I guess all with guns drawn. It does make you wonder why weren't they able to, end this without, in a different way.
Well, going back to what she said, Officer Vinson, I can't imagine if he did not pull the trigger, he would not be.
Yeah.
I can't really buy into that conspiracy theory because he's received death threats. It's my understanding that at some point he was under protective custody. I just can't see somebody who didn't pull the trigger saying, I'll take one for the team in this.
Right.
Because
yeah,
at this point,
no officer's doing that.
that's the allegation.
Right.
That he's taking one for the team.
But regardless of – I just don't see that.
Well, the other thing that this shows again is just that nobody trusts anybody.
Yeah.
Agreed set of facts does not exist.
Right. Yeah.
Right. So much so that the family felt the need to have the independent autopsy done because they said they weren't getting answers from Charlotte Mecklenburg medical examiner.
Okay. Let's move on to CMS. They've begun their magnet changes. They took the school board got their first look at a preliminary plan to diversify magnet schools this week. Diversification would be based on socioeconomic status, and the lottery system would be overhauled to encourage a mix of students from different economic backgrounds. What was the board's reaction?
It was pretty positive. I mean, the proposed plan seemed to go over pretty well with the the revisions to the lottery.
And the plan uses geography to determine socioeconomic status. In other words, the general economic level of neighborhoods would determine these things. Is that an accurate indicator, and particularly given the blended nature of increasingly gentrified areas?
Yeah, gentrification is kind of the thing that throws this all off a little bit. I mean, what they're going to do, what it's going to come down to basically is where you live. And they are going to look at socioeconomic status, and they are going to ask parents to report, you know, how much they make, their education level, their English, if that's their first language in their home. But they can't just go off of that because that's voluntary. You can't make parents give off that information. So they're going through a lot of census data as well.
So it's mid-October. They're going to make a decision on this, or they're going to vote on this, on November the 9th. Do they intend to roll this out for comments between then and now?
Yeah, they do, I believe.
October 25th.
Does that give sufficient time to get sufficient comments in what, 2 weeks, 3 weeks?
Well, they've been talking about it in public settings for forever. Yeah. So it does kind of feel like they need to, you know, all right, do something already.
The board also intends now, they announced on Monday, to add a non-voting student member to their ranks and to let that student have a voice in hiring both the new superintendent and in reshaping student assignment. Where did this idea come from?
Not from Bill James.
he did not seem to be a fan.
The old Bill James has returned at long last. Bill James said in an open letter to the school board, "Don't bring a child to our meetings." He said, "I'm not interested in debating or listening to or arguing with a CMS student who isn't elected by the people of Mecklenburg County. I will not engage with him or her, nor waste valuable public time debating with him or her." That sounds like Bill James.
Yeah. You, sir, are a scamp.
So how have other commissioners reacted to this?
I think more are open to the idea.
But what about that? This person would be unelected. So should county commissioners, should school board people listen to this person? Why not listen?
Yes,
yeah,
they
why
should.
Not? I mean, I understand not wanting to get into a debate, you know, with a non-elected student, but I feel like there could be some value with hearing what students are concerned about
But is a high school student qualified to help choose a superintendent of schools?
Well, I think the type of—
Does their opinion matter?
I think the type of student who would wind up in that position, yeah, that student's opinion.
Well,
because that's going to be the best and the brightest, the smartest, the quickest.
You're assuming that. Are you not? How will this person be
chosen?
The
class clowns don't want to be coming to school board meetings.
Right. How will this person be chosen? Do we know that?
I don't know that.
I don't know the answer to that.
I think each high school is going to elect somebody to a central board, and the board will vote on the one person who then goes to the school board meetings. I think that's how it's going to work. And there was a letter to the editor today in the paper that talked about listening to this person, because we should listen to everybody.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I mean, constituent input. I mean, I know this is a little bit of a different structure, but I don't get the sense that this high school student is going to be put in charge of the entire education system. So I don't see it as a, you know, terribly damaging thing to get some insight from.
Yeah, I really don't understand.
A consumer, so to speak.
I don't understand why Bill James is so tied up in knots over this. I think he may see it as, you know, diminishing his position or something to have a kid be able to sort of address him as an equal. I don't get it.
Yeah, I don't know.
I had forgotten about Bill James, and now he's back, and so I remember him. Could that play a role, do you think?
Maybe that was it, Mike. Maybe that was it all along.
I don't know where to go from here. We only have 90 seconds left, and the Panthers are 1-3.
1-4.
The 1-4?
Yeah, you're being generous.
See, I deny that. It may be a fact, but I deny it.
You could not watch Monday night. It didn't happen.
Cam was out last week. He was supposed. So I guess he's returning on Sunday for their home game against the Saints.
Road game.
It's a road game. Okay.
Possibly returning.
I'm sorry. Yes, and it's going to be in that noisy dome.
Yes.
Can the Panthers get out of this?
Yeah, they can. I mean,
really? Make the playoffs?
Let's put it
or
this
is
way.
That done?
The Saints are even worse than the Panthers right now. They should, but
they're playing in their
also,
building.
Also, Tampa Bay was even worse than the Panthers. So who knows? But they do have Cam back, or hopefully they have Jonathan Stewart back. And when you have both of those guys back on offense, that changes the calculus.
In the whole Rivera era, they've been doing a really good job end of the season, winning a lot of games, ruining their draft choices. So I can actually see them making a run. Also, Atlanta has a history of great starts and then...
And
they're moving the game to 1 o'clock. The NFL moved two games game times this week, and they moved this game to 1 o'clock. Is that because of rankings of these two teams? This is no longer the primetime game?
Yeah,
because
they actually moved the October 30th game, the Arizona game. From 4 o'clock to 1 o'clock, but because it is not...
A primetime game anymore.
Yes, it is. These teams are not going in the right direction, so you are relegated to 1 o'clock,
sir. It's hurting the tailgate, though.
And on that happy note, we must leave. I want to thank everybody for being here. Eric Spanberg from the Business Journal, Eric Frazier from the Charlotte Observer, Sean Flynn from Time Warner Cable News, and Sarah D'Elia from Down the Hall at WFAE News. Thank you all.
Thanks, Mike.